Oh, thanks everybody for coming out tonight. I'd like to talk about two things this evening and then turn it loose for questions, because I know we're going to try to keep this segment short to get folks out of here perhaps before the weather turns bad. I'd like to do two things. Number one, build out a little bit about what Gail said about our history so that folks understand who we are and what we do. And the second part of it is to talk about what we do now and what lessons we've learned from the last 15 years. I can't count the number of times over the last 15 years. I probably could, but it would be very discouraging probably in some ways. But count the number of times that I've been in auditoriums or in communities talking to groups similar to this about a project that's coming into their community that they don't want. And not only do they not want it, they actually understand that it is inherently dangerous and that there are adverse effects and harms that flow from it. And they're trying to figure out why something so obvious to them, that a project is inherently dangerous to the local community, why would the state permit that to happen? Why would governments at the state and federal level actually work on behalf of a few corporate folks to actually put their rights in a higher position than the folks that live in communities? And it's unfortunate to say, and sometimes we come in and deliver as much bad news as we do good, but it's unfortunate to say, but our legal structure in the United States is set up to do exactly that. It actually places rights on behalf of those folks who are doing, shorthand for us, is property and commerce stuff. Over the rights of people and communities where that corporation is trying to put X, Y, and Z in that the community opposes. Now, we didn't start with that conclusion 15 years ago when I began practicing law. We didn't begin with that conclusion. We didn't wake up one morning at 8, 9 o'clock, whatever, and say, hey, the structure is set up to screw you as communities. We didn't wake up with that. What we woke up doing was, as Gail recounted, providing free legal services to community-based environmental groups. Because we figured, you know, what they teach you back in law school is that the United States has the best environmental laws of any place. And in fact, our environmental laws here are so good that we export them out to other countries. That's how good our environmental laws here in the United States. And when you asked as a law student, you said, well, if the environmental laws are so good in this country, why is it that things are getting so bad outside? Why is it that by almost every major environmental statistic in the United States today, things are worse now than they were 40 years ago when the major federal environmental laws were adopted here in this country? And the answer that you get in law school is, well, there's not enough people enforcing the laws. And so that's one reason why we created the Legal Defense Fund, was to provide free legal help to communities who couldn't otherwise afford legal assistance. And legal assistance now in some places where we work is up to $900 an hour for a lawyer to provide some kind of specialty environmental services. So we thought we'd add a couple more lawyers, because we framed the problem as not enough lawyers. And today we frame it perhaps a little differently as too many lawyers in the system, but we'll get to that in a minute. So in terms of providing services, at one point in Pennsylvania, which is where we're headquartered right now, we had 300 community clients across the state. And every day would pretty much start the same for us. And I don't know if anybody's ever seen the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. For those who haven't, Bill Murray wakes up every morning and he lives the same day over and over and over again. And eventually he throws a plugged-in toaster into the bathtub with him to try to end that same day going on and on and on. We didn't come to that point, but we came close. And when I say Groundhog Day, what I mean is that we would pick up the phone and communities such as yours, from the different places where you're from, would call us and they would say, we have a toxic waste incinerator coming into our community. Or we have a corporation that wants to put a landfill in. Or dump sewage sludge from Philadelphia into our land within our municipality. Or put in a 15,000 head hog factory farm. And our definition of sustainability, our definition of and vision for the future about where we want our community to go, doesn't include a toxic waste incinerator in the middle of our community or a 15,000 head hog factory farm. And they would say to us, we want you to help us stop it. We want you to help us say no to it. And it was that point, and this is the Groundhog Day part of it, that we had to explain to them, as conventional, traditionally trained environmental lawyers, that communities are prohibited in the United States from saying no to legal uses, L-E-G-A-L. I'm going to say it again. There's no dispute among, you can ask the corporate lawyers, you can ask the environmental lawyers, it doesn't matter who you ask. It's well-settled black-letter law in the United States. And it stands for this proposition, that municipalities are prohibited from banning legal uses, L-E-G-A-L. Once again, black-letter law in the United States for the past 100 years in the United States. Now, the question you may ask is, what's a legal use then? And why? And the second question you should be asking is, why does my municipality have its hands tied from actually saying no to something coming in that we know is inherently dangerous? Well, almost everything has been defined as a legal use under the law. So big box stores, electric transmission lines, pork production, you name it, they've all been defined as legal uses. And to cut to the quick, instead of trying to exactly define what legal use is within the system, you can rest assured that if a project needs a permit from anyone, from the federal government or from the state government or some state agency, that it is automatically a legal use within the community. Because it's a legal use, municipalities are prohibited from banning legal uses. I said three times because it's so important to what I'm going to say tonight, because it's where we started with this. Now, some folks say, well, Mr. Lindsay, that's not true. We have zoning ordinances, and of course we can ban legal uses within our municipality. Well, zoning ordinances are not about banning uses municipality-wide. What zoning ordinances are about is separating out incompatible land uses from each other, so residential from commercial, commercial from industrial. You may be able to ban a use within a zone, but if you attempt to use the zoning ordinance to ban a use municipality-wide, what you're looking at next is a big fat lawsuit from a corporation affected by the zoning decision to ban the use municipality-wide. And that comes with a claim that you have violated the corporation's constitutional rights within your municipality. Now, corporate constitutional rights, something we're going to take and put in the parking lot for now, because I'm going to talk about it in a couple minutes. But suffice it to say, and I had this conversation with the mayor of Spokane, Washington a couple years ago, and she was arguing about corporate rights, and I was arguing back with her. The fact is, if a community like Spokane, Washington, 200,000 people, says we don't want big box stores in our community because big box stores means that our downtown gets vacuumed out, all of our local business and local merchants and those types of things, and the city council says we're going to ban them and pass the one paragraph ordinance to ban big box stores, the first thing you're going to get is a lawsuit from Walmart or Costco or one of the big box stores saying you violated our corporate constitutional 5th and 14th Amendment rights, right? Once again, we're going to take that and put it in the parking lot, but that's a real-life example. Going back to Groundhog Day, we would say to these communities that were calling our office who wanted us to help them say no to these uses, we would say, we'd love to. We'd love to help you say no, but the system doesn't allow you to say no. So what we're going to do instead is to do what we've been trained to do as conventional environmental lawyers, which is appeal the permit that's been issued from the state to the corporation to put in the project that you're opposing. Where did that put us? Well, it put us where all conventional lawyers end up, even today, which is, in one hand, you have the permit application from the corporation that has submitted it. On the other side, you have the regulations that control the issuance of the permit itself from the agency. And we would take those two bodies of information and we would do our darndest to try to find places where the corporation missed something, that there was a gap or a omission or a deficiency of some kind within their permit application. Just to be real practical, in Pennsylvania, to put in a toxic waste incinerator, you have to post a $500,000 bond for the roads that are going in and feeding the facility to take care of the roads in case they get damaged. We would find permit applications that only had a $250,000 bond attached. So technically, they didn't meet the regulations. Regulations also say things like the president of a company needs to sign the application. We would find instances where the treasurer or the secretary signed the application, but not the president. So we would walk in front of the administrative law judge and we would say, Your Honor, under Roman numeral 2 little c little 2 little I little e little a little Roman numeral 2 little c little I, that the permit application was deficient, the state agency erred, the permit never should have issued, and therefore we're asking Your Honor to overturn the permit and throw out the permit issuance. And by and large, we were successful. We had a win-loss rate of 137-6, something like that, in front of the administrative law judges. It's not because we had silver tongues. It was because 90% of all the permits that are issued never get appealed because nobody can afford to appeal them. So sometimes in life, showing up is half the battle. And by showing up and making common sense arguments, we were able to get these things tossed. What would happen next, as Gail said, was that we would have a victory party. The community group would have a victory party at their house, right? We'd have some beer and we'd have some wine and we'd pat ourselves on the back. And people would say things like, the system works. The system works. We had a problem. We came together around a kitchen table. We figured out the problem. We moved forward. We picked up the phone. We called the lawyer. We found a lawyer. The lawyer argued the case. The judge listened. Everything was reasonable. He was a nice guy. And now we're not going to get the toxic waste incinerator in the middle of our community. We're not going to get the 15,000 head hog factory farm here. Well, what would happen 6 weeks later? The corporation would come back. And this time they'd come back with a new and improved permit application that filled in the gaps, deficiencies, and omissions that we had so carefully found and had built the first case on. In fact, I had some corporate lawyers come up to me during this process, who I got to know fairly well, thanking us for finding those gaps, omissions, and deficiencies in the permit application. The community group would come back to us and they would say, Mr. Lindsay, we need you to do that jiu-jitsu again that you did the first time around, because we don't want this factory farm here. We don't want this, you know, big thing coming in that we don't want in our community. We would look back at them and we would say, we're sorry, right? There's no more levers for us to use because in the regulatory stuff that governs this issuance, they have now complied with everything. They have the president signed it. They have the $500,000 bond. You name it, they've done it. They've filled in the gaps, deficiencies, and omissions. And what would happen 6 months from then? The community would get the toxic waste incinerator. The community would get the factory farm. What we began to see was how the regulatory system was used as an enabler. They're not called permits for nothing. They permit something to occur. They legalize it. A lot of us are used to seeing the regulatory system as protecting health, safety, and welfare. People still come up to us and say, well, the regulatory system is broken because it's not protecting our health, safety, and welfare. And we look back at them and we say, maybe it's working perfectly. Because maybe its point is not to protect health, safety, and welfare. Maybe the point is to make our activism predictable, because the regulations are written by the very corporations that ostensibly they're supposed to be regulating. And perhaps it's working perfectly because it's actually successfully forcing the project into the community, and it's a way of the state enabling the corporation to actually force that project in over our objections. And it was also at that point that we thought, well, at least we're costing the corporations money. Because when we go and argue the permit appeal, they have to get a lawyer, and then we go in and we argue with each other, and they have to pay that guy, and he costs $1,000 an hour. Right? It was then that we learned that the monies that the corporations spend on the permit objection process, the whole regulatory process, is tax deductible. And it's tax deductible as a reasonable and necessary business expense under the law. So we really weren't costing them anything at all. And the final thing that somebody said to me back in the late 1990s when we were doing this in the midst of this work, she said something that was very interesting to me. She said, the only thing that regulations regulate, the only thing that environmental regulations regulate is us. Because they make our work in our communities predictable. Because they establish a script written by the corporations who wrote the regulations in the first place for us to play under. And by God, we do a really good job of it because we follow our instructions to a T. I've watched community after community, like a hamster running through the wheel, go through these various processes and eventually get exhausted and then dismantle themselves. It is a recipe for exhausting communities. That's what the regulatory process and system is. That's one of the conclusions we came to. The other conclusion we came to, a lot of people don't care. There's a liberal progressive community. I'm going to slaughter some sacred cows here tonight, but there's a liberal progressive community that looked at our win-loss record, 137-7 or whatever it was, and they said to themselves, this is one of the best environmental law firms in the country, right? Legal defense law. And we got invited to the White House 1 year as one of the best environmental law firms in the country. And we got the awards, and we got the funding. We got all the stuff that people really enjoy, you know, the good stuff, the benefits from some of the being successful. But if you looked at that 137-7 win-loss record, and you actually walked into the community, communities like Chester, Pennsylvania, communities like Belfast Township in the central part of the state, you would find that the projects that they had fought all went in eventually. It's almost like environmental law is celebrated as the thing that allows stuff to come in and maybe begs the corporations to do a little less damage as they're putting it in. I mean, that's kind of the conclusion we came to with environmental. So, cutting to the quick, what did we do? Well, we decided to close shop. We decided to close down because the work that we were doing was actually to help communities to stop things from coming in. What we thought working within the permit system was a way to at least delay it or make it more expensive, those types of things, and not to help corporations build better permit applications, because that's in essence what we were doing. It was at that point in time that our phones started ringing off the hook again, and this time with a constituency that we were not established to assist. And the constituency was rural elected municipal officials, known as township supervisors, in some of the smallest places in rural parts of Pennsylvania. What was their issue back in starting in 1998? A small handful of the largest agribusiness corporations in the country, keeping in mind that 80% of pork production today is controlled by six major agribusiness corporations in the United States. It's no different from the chicken industry. Six corporations control 70% of poultry processing. One corporation, Kraft, controls over 70% of cheese production in the United States today. So we've had a corporatization of agriculture, which probably should come as no surprise to people in this room. The fact was that a small number of these agribusiness corporations were looking to set up shop in central Pennsylvania, very rural, conservative central Pennsylvania. They ran into a problem in these plans of theirs to put in 15,000 head, 20,000 head hog factory farms. And the problem was that the small communities had banded together, about 100 of them, and passed really stringent local laws dealing with liquid manure disposal from these facilities. Anybody who's familiar with these vertically integrated concentrated animal feeding operations knows they put out a prodigious amount of shit. And that stuff has to be taken care of somehow. And so these municipalities said, we are going to pass laws making it prohibitively expensive to dispose of liquid manure on land within the municipality to a point where it was prohibitive, cost prohibitive to put something in. So it was essentially a ban in these 100 municipalities, a regulatory-type ban making it too expensive to put in factory farms. These agribusiness corporations, they came in, and they looked at the bans, and they said, wow, those will stop us from coming in. We can't set up shop there. So what did they do? They went to the Pennsylvania legislature, state legislature, and they drafted a bill called the Nutrient Management Act. All right? This might sound the same Orwellian to you as some of the stuff that's happened in New Hampshire. The Nutrient Management Act said if you want to put in a factory farm, all you have to do is submit a nutrient management plan to the state agency. That's all you have to do. We're going to require that. It's a planning option, planning module. You put it into the state. And because we're doing that, good people of the state of Pennsylvania, in your little municipality, silly little people, since we're doing that as a state, you don't have to do that at the municipal level. You don't have to do that at the community. And so we're going to preempt you from enforcing or adopting any new ordinances that are more stringent than the state law. In one snap, in this case the governor's signature, all 100 ordinances were preempted and nullified at the local level. What happened next was these factory farms started setting up shop. What happened after that? The supervisors in these rural areas started calling us. And they started calling us saying, we need help. And we said, well, we don't know if we can help you. We weren't set up to help you. We were set up to do community organizations and that kind of stuff. And they said, well, we don't have any other place else to turn. We said, okay. I didn't know Shinola about ag, so we had a tough learning curve. We learned all about it. And these folks said, well, we're getting caught in a vice. We have our residents. If a factory farm moves in a quarter of a mile from you, you lose 60% of your property value overnight. That's what the statistics show. We have residents shouting at us, and on the other side, we have our lawyer, our municipal lawyer. So the residents are saying, you've got to do something about factory farms coming in, because we don't want them here in this community. We don't want this corporatization of agriculture. And on the other side, you have the lawyer, the municipal lawyer that the supervisors, the elected officials, turned to, and they said, help us, we need to do something here. And the lawyer said, you can't do anything. And the supervisor said, wait a minute, what do you mean we can't do anything? And the lawyer for the municipality said, well, because the state passed this law, and it preempts you now from doing anything at the local level. And the elected officials said, well, wait a minute, I thought we made the rules here. right? Not the state, and especially because the corporations wrote a bill that then went into the state legislature. And I got to tell you, for folks that have never seen the state legislature operate, I used to work in the legislature, bills are written by folks other than the legislators, and then are passed off to the committees that have an interest in that particular issue, and then they pretty much run through if they have the majority support of the corporations, or at least the agribusiness corporations, that are in favor of that particular piece of legislation. So forgive me if I popped anybody's bubble there about how things actually function in that world. But at the same time, these elected officials were caught in between this vice. And they said, we need help. And we said, well, we don't know what kind of help we can give you, but maybe we should try to crack this thing in a different way. And so in conversations with them, we would try our same tried and true little song that we gave to folks 5 years before, which is they said, well, we want to stop it. And we said, well, you can't stop it because you can't say no. Factory farms are a legal use. They get a permit from the state now, and so you can't prohibit them here. And then something started to happen at that point in time that made this work different from all the other work that other activists and communities are doing. And the difference was that those elected officials started asking why. So we said, well, communities can't prohibit legal uses. And they said, why? And I said, well, if you try to prohibit a legal use, you automatically buy a corporate lawsuit that says you're taking certain things from the corporations, therefore you're violating their corporate constitutional rights. And of course, corporations have the same rights as persons in the United States. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. And I was on the phone, I still remember the phone call, the guy on the other end of the line, it was a supervisor from the township of 700 people. He said, why? I said, well, corporations have constitutional rights. The Supreme Court in 1886 said corporations have the same rights as persons in the United States. And corporations have other constitutional rights, like Commerce Clause rights, where they can overturn municipalities if municipalities dare to try to regulate types of commerce. And I remember being on the phone with him, and he said, why? And I said, well, it goes back to the constitutional structure. The U.S. Constitution has provisions in it that basically place certain rights and values over others. And it was very easy for corporations to get constitutional rights because the Constitution protects property and commerce. Corporations are the predominant vehicles of property and commerce. And therefore, it made sense that that constitutional stuff would eventually be stretched to protect corporations. And then there was silence, and then and he said, why? Right? Why is that the case? So why? Well, it goes back to English common law, and the folks who wrote the U.S. Constitution, they were schooled in English common law, and English common law was about putting certain rights above others because England was a colonial power, and they were colonizing other places, and so they wrote a system of law that legalized all the violence and terror and all that nasty stuff that the colonial powers did, right? There was a long silence after that one. And he said, why was that? And I said, well, I have no idea why that was. Probably goes back to the banks of the Nile. I don't know. But the way that the system has evolved, it has evolved in such a way that the corporate boys who want to bring these things in have more rights under the law than the communities in which they seek to do business. That's how the structure of law is set up. And I'm going to break that down as the last piece of what I talk about tonight. So anyway, these communities pushed us, which has been our history. I mean, people come to me and they say, well, thank you for doing this or thank you for doing that. And I look back and then I say, well, thank you. Because without the communities actually pushing the envelope, building a whole new structure of law, because that's what we're talking about here tonight. The old structure of law has probably breathed its last breath. It no longer works for us because it has allowed government to become corporatized. Government is now corporatized. In the democracy schools that we teach, we talk about a corporate state. People think it's the corporation that's the problem. People forget sometimes that the corporation is chartered by the state. It's chartered by government. And it wouldn't have the powers it has without government giving those powers to them. The problem is not just corporation. It's the state structure that enables the corporation to do what it does to you, right? So it's more than just the corporation that you meet. Most of the communities that we work with, whether it's factory farms or sludge or fracking, because we're now working with communities on fracking issues across the United States, doesn't matter what the issue is. You would think that people would come into contact with the corporation first, but they don't. They come into contact with the structure of law first, because the structure of law subordinates them to the corporation. and it's been doing so for the past 150 years in this country. So sometimes it's hard to get our brain around that stuff. But people can, and people have, and people continue to, including these folks in rural Pennsylvania, some of whom only have GEDs within these municipal governmental levels. And they said to us, we don't care. If we do nothing, we're going to get the factory farm coming in here. And if we do the regulatory stuff, we may get a change to the nutrient management plan that the corporation has submitted. We might get, you know, 5 pounds less hog crap dumped on the acre next to us, but we're still going to get the factory farm if we do the regulatory stuff. We're still going to get it. So if you do the regulatory stuff, you're still going to get the project. And then they said, this is the only path available to us. The joke back in the office is that we're known as the law firm of last resort. It's after folks have gone through all the remedies that they think that they have. We use the toolbox analogy tonight. These folks have emptied the toolbox. Their only option is to build a completely new toolbox or pick up the existing toolbox and use it as a thing to hit the other folks on the head with, one or the other. They're out of options. It's not like you on a Wednesday you say, I'm going to take on the largest agribusiness corporations in the country tomorrow just for kicks. They don't do it for kicks. They found something that's so valued within their community that they are unwilling to take no for an answer. It's when revolutions start. That's when they start when people are out of options. They are out of remedies within their existing governmental structure. It's the only time, I think, that things actually change, and change in a structural way, not just to work for less parts per million or paper versus plastic or the types of choices that we're given in this country every week or every month. It's about changing the basic structure under which we operate to make real the promises that have come to us through the New Hampshire Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and these other documents that people died for, to put that language in there. The right to revolution, the right to change governments, it's in the New Hampshire Constitution. It's not in any other constitution. It's here, and it's only here. And so the issue for us at some point working with these communities, and in Pennsylvania, the communities that said, well, if we regulate it, we're going to get it. If we do nothing, we're going to get it. We need to do something different. What do? We help them to put bans on corporate farming into place in central Pennsylvania, openly and frontally challenging a structure of law that generally says you've got to allow stuff. These guys stood up, and I said, why are you standing up? You might get sued. In fact, there's a very good chance you're going to get sued. And they said to me something that stood with me today, all the way last 15, 10 years. And they said, if we do it, maybe somebody else will do it. And if somebody else does it, maybe somebody else will do it. And maybe eventually enough places will do it to actually force the change that needs to take so that our communities are actually self-governing entities rather than stepchildren to the state system of government and the federal system of government, which constantly tells us what we can and we can't do, right? And from that day on, I thought about things in a completely different way, taking off the lawyer hat. Because there are plenty of lawyers. You probably run into them already. Municipal lawyers especially. We've worked with over 100 sets of municipal lawyers over the past 15 years. 100 sets. They tend to run the gamut from lawyers that know that something's structurally wrong and that something needs to be fixed, but who have taken the same oath to uphold the Constitution and the law and everything else. They're officers of the court, et cetera, et cetera. Who basically write a memo. You know, you take the sustainable energy ordinance to them. They write a memo. We call it the save your ass memo. Which they write, which says, basically, this goes against every tenet of law that I've learned since I graduated from law school, but it's a political question for the people of the community to decide. So they lay out the risks, they say, here's the risks of what you're doing, but in the end, it's not the lawyer's decision, it's the community's decision about what to do. Sometimes I think we get caught up too much in the expert and the lawyer crap, and forget what our role is actually self-governing citizens, or what that's supposed to be. The other set of lawyers are a much bigger problem. They're the folks that are used to actually running your governments. And so in some places, at least in Pennsylvania, you have the engineer and the lawyer who run the governments, and then everybody else who's elected is basically subordinate to them. And so in those places, the lawyer will actively try to stop you from doing what you want to do in the community. Not by just saying it's illegal and unconstitutional, which are the bywords that they always use to try to kill the thing, but actually moving forward to try to keep things off warrant articles, off town meetings, like happened in Maine with one of our communities where the select board refused to put something onto the ballot, even though it was petitioned and everything else. Community there had to go around their select board to have another meeting, a special meeting, and adopt something themselves. And so, dropping back to Pennsylvania for a moment, what happened in Pennsylvania was we started with five communities banning corporate farms from operating in their communities. It then went to 12. We had 12 communities doing that. And then a new issue emerged, the land application of sewage sludge. Guess what? There's four corporations that control 60% of sludge hauling in the United States. That takes sewage sludge, which can contain up to 100,000 different toxic contaminants, especially the stuff brought from Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and the big city areas, to put on farmland. And they make money because they charge the authorities to pay the corporation to bring the sludge over. Needless to say, or to add on, that those communities learned what was happening with the corporate farming stuff. They came to us, asked us to develop an ordinance. We did. First five passed it, then 10, then 20, then 50, then 60, then 80. We're up to 84 communities in Pennsylvania that have adopted those ordinances as well. So at one point in Pennsylvania, we had 110. We now have 100 and close to 140 across the United States. About 110 of those are in Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania is the big place where all this happened. And to perhaps eliminate that last vestige of hope, I know it did for me, that the state legislature was actually going to help us in some way to exercise our right to self-government, that the first thing that the legislature did under pressure from the agribusiness corporations in the state of Pennsylvania was to pass a law called ACRE, which authorized the attorney general of the state to sue the municipality to overturn the ordinances that they had adopted. Okay? I want to pause there because we're moving pretty quickly. This is an important point. You would think that maybe the state legislature, after 110 communities would pass something, that the state legislature would say, hey, maybe these folks have a point. And maybe we should be passing legislation to liberate them to actually do their own lawmaking at the local level. Au contraire. When the agribusiness corporations exercised their power within the legislature, what happened next was the state legislature now allows those agribusiness corporations to pick up the phone, call the attorney general's office, who's paid for by public monies, and the attorney general then brings a lawsuit on behalf of the state against the municipality to overturn the ordinance that they've adopted to, in essence, set the future vision for their own community. No longer do the corporations even need to pay their own money. They now use the state entity to drive forward that ordinance overturning. So, I always apologize for my stance, but pardon me, the fact is, nobody's going to help you. That's the other thing I usually say right off the bat. You have nobody that's going to help you. The state government's not going to help you. The environmental groups probably are not going to help you. The big environmental groups are all trapped in the regulatory stuff. When we start to color outside the lines, which is the interesting little scenario that we call it by, which is moving outside of this box of allowable remedies that you've been placed in when these types of things happen, that when you start to move outside that box of allowable activism, there's all kinds of stuff that happens to punish you for moving outside that box of allowable activism. It's not something that the main environmental groups, the major ones, have any stomach for. They continue to pretend that the remedies within that box are enough to actually protect the community from the harms that it's seeking to protect itself from. We take the opposite view, which is that staying within the box guarantees that you're going to get the harm that's coming to you. It's only by going outside the box that you're actually going to be able to do anything different. Now, going outside the box carries significant risk of being punished by the system that's been built over the past 100 years. This system has been concocted very carefully over the last 100 years to keep you in a subordinate position to the folks that want to use your community for something, whether it's extraction of resources, whether it's using it to put something through the community. No matter what the use is that's planned for the community, the law has been stitched together and very carefully manufactured over the last 100 years to make sure that you're stuck in this box of allowable remedies, which will not allow you to actually protect your community. Now, what are some of those doctrines that push in on the box? That's what I'm going to finish up with. This is part of the lessons that we've learned. Well, in Pennsylvania, the question to us was, what legal doctrines stop us from moving outside the box? What legal doctrines stop a community from saying no to something that they know is going to harm them? And so we use Pennsylvania as a laboratory of sorts. We tried it in different places with different formulations and different ordinances and different types of paragraphs in those ordinances and different language to see what it drew from the corporate boys and the corporate lawyers, some of the biggest law firms in the country, retained by these coal companies and the landfill corporations and the energy corporations, you name it. And what we discovered over the years was that there is a script that the corporate boys work from, that if we know the script, we know the terms of it, it could be very helpful to us in designing a defense so that when we say no in our communities, it's done intelligently with an effort to actually nullify those doctrines within the community that we're in. So, what are those doctrines? Well, Gail mentioned one. It's preemption. We don't think too much of preemption, I think, sometimes. We just think it's the normal course of activity in the republic in which we live in. But since kindergarten, we're all taught that federal government trumps the state trumps the local. That's basically how we've come to think of our system. In law school, they do nothing to break you of that. If you think about it, preemption is the ultimate undemocratic tool because it takes decision-making power away from the locality to a higher level of government and a fewer number of hands. That's what preemption is all about. To make the story even more interesting, preemption in most states is a judicial construct. It's not contained in the Constitution, not contained in the statutes. It's actually a judicial construct that builds on the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution that says the federal government should be supreme to the state. And so preemption is a very big issue because the state can preempt you as a community in all kinds of ways. And preemption on its face is when the state comes in to regulate something that is a harm to the community, thus eliminating the ability of the community to legislate in the same area that the state has then preempted the municipality in. The second doctrine is called Dillon's Rule. Gail mentioned it as one of the doctrines that controls our decision-making. Who the hell was Dillon? Well, Dillon was John Dillon, not the gangster, but the lawyer. In fact, he was probably a gangster as well. So John Dillon was the justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, and he came up with this rule called Dillon's Rule. He used to work for the railroad companies, and his job as a railroad lawyer was to keep municipal governments like yours from interfering with the railroad corporations as they laid the line westward for the railroad companies. His job was to insulate the railroad companies from actions of the municipalities. He came up with a rule called Dillon's Rule, and Dillon's Rule stands for this, that the relationship between the state and the municipality is one of a parent to a child, that municipalities are creations of the state and only have the powers that the state explicitly gives to them. Okay? That's Dillon's Rule. Dillon went even so far as to say, your elected officials at the municipal level are not necessary because the municipality is set up as an administrator of state law, and it doesn't matter whether you elect them. The state could appoint them for all it matters because they're just carrying out the dictates of the state. So it's called Dillon's Rule. The final piece of this is called corporate constitutional rights. We've been over some of it. Unfortunately, in the United States today, say unfortunately, it's been law for a long time, corporations have been deemed to be persons under the law. And what does that mean? Well, corporations have the same First Amendment rights as you do. And the most recent example of this is that Citizens United decision, which came down in 2010, that corporations have First Amendment rights that can't be interfered with by federal campaign finance legislation. That was the chunk of it. Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizures. Corporations have the same rights as you under the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits things like OSHA from doing surprise inspections of workplaces because they violate the corporation's Fourth Amendment rights. Fifth Amendment deals with takings and due process and all those kinds of things about property being taken without just compensation. Corporations have those rights. Corporations have 14th Amendment equal protection rights. So if you attempt to treat corporate farmers differently from family farmers, and both are treated as persons under the law, that you're violating the constitutional rights of the corporate farmers, throwing a lot at you in a short period of time. But suffice it to say that corporations have this range of constitutional rights. Some people track that back to 1886, others to 1819. Corporate person is actually something that's been alive since the 1700s for trading companies and ecclesiastical corporations and all those types of things. In addition to personhood rights, corporations have commerce clause rights. The commerce clause in the Constitution says issues of commerce, interstate commerce especially, are issues reserved to the federal level of government. So you are prohibited at the state or local level of government from passing laws that interferes with interstate commerce. And the most well-known case for that is when Virginia tried to ban out-of-state waste from coming in. The U.S. Supreme Court said, wait a minute, waste or garbage is commerce under the U.S. Constitution, and therefore states and localities can't ban or regulate garbage flow across their borders. That was actual U.S. Supreme Court decision. So corporate personhood rights, corporate non-personhood rights combined with Dillon's rule, combined with preemption. There's a fourth doctrine which talks about nature as property. We tend not to think of it too much, but ecosystems are owned in our system of law, which means that if you're a corporation with enough money and wealth to own the most ecosystems, that you can destroy the most ecosystems because you can own them. And so nature is property within the municipality. That's the fourth legal doctrine. Why are they important? They're important for this reason. They are privately enforceable by the corporations affected by municipal lawmaking. It's not the state that comes in to say, hey, you've been preempted and you can't pass this. The entity that comes in is the corporation itself, who comes in and says, count one, you're preempted, you can't pass this. Count two, under Dillon's rule, you don't have the power to pass this. Count three, you violated our due process and takings rights, and therefore you violated our constitutional rights. And oh, by the way, if you try to treat nature as anything else but property in your municipality, you can't do that either because nature is property under the law. And so these lawsuits, when I talk about Pennsylvania being a laboratory, these lawsuits are boilerplated on the desks of the corporate lawyers. It doesn't matter what issue you're dealing with, they just fill in the blanks, and it's very easy for them to do so because the structure is the same no matter what issue you're facing. So whether it's factory farms or Nestle Corporation taking water out from places in Maine and New Hampshire, whether it's fracking taking place in the Northeast and other places, it doesn't matter what the issue is. What you have been is systematically divested of any authority at the local level to actually control the future of your own community. That's what's at stake here. So it's not a Northern Pass issue. It's a democracy issue. That's what it is. And combined with other communities that are working on other issues where they understand it's a democracy issue, the long-term challenge here is to build enough of a critical mass of municipalities to actually force the state structure to change. That may be state legislative change. It may be state constitutional change. The only answer to your problems, and there's no magic bullet. Folks think we're coming at it, it's a magic bullet. We don't have a magic bullet. What we have is a process which says if you care enough about your single issue, it means making structural change within the state itself to legalize the laws that you're passing at the higher levels. That's the key. And that's what folks in other places are doing, like Pennsylvania. Final piece here, just in November of 2010, the city of Pittsburgh became the largest municipal government in the United States to work with us to adopt an ordinance within the community. They adopted it unanimously by their city council, and it does three things, which is what all of our ordinances do now. Number one, they created a local bill of rights for the residents of the city of Pittsburgh. Sometimes it's hard to get our brains around it because we think, oh, Bill of Rights, that's the state Bill of Rights or the federal Bill of Rights. You have a movement in the United States which has been called a new civil rights movement to actually expand civil, political, and environmental rights at the municipal level as an expansion of rights within the municipality. The second thing Pittsburgh did was ban fracking because you couldn't have fracking without violating the local Bill of Rights that had been put into place, which called for things like a right to clean air and clean water, right to sustainable energy future in the Pittsburgh ordinance that was passed, those types of things. So the fracking was not naked. The ban on fracking was not naked. It was actually an implementation of the Bill of Rights. And the third thing, quite extraordinary in the city of Pittsburgh, as well as these 130 other places that have passed it, was to say corporations, specifically natural gas corporations within the city of Pittsburgh, shall not have constitutional rights and powers of persons or other constitutional powers within the city of Pittsburgh. in addition to if the state issues a permit that violates our ordinance, that the permit is void within the city of Pittsburgh. And perhaps even more amazingly, they declared that ecosystems and nature within the city of Pittsburgh were not property, but actually had rights of their own that could be defended by the residents of the community themselves. What you're talking about is a whole new structure of law, which takes the existing constitutional structure of law, which places property and commerce above the people of rights, communities, and nature, and actually turning it upside down as a blueprint to a new system of constitutional law that eventually has to change, otherwise you will always be subordinate to it in your own communities, no matter what issues you face. This year it's Northern Pass, for the next couple of years it's Northern Pass. There are going to be other things. It is going to get worse. It is going to get a lot worse. What's happening right now is the large companies are scrambling for resources, and whereby they used to be able to extract and use those resources in places that were not inhabited, they're running out of those places to use, and they're now coming to you, and they're coming to your communities. There's a place in Colorado now where the corporation's actually digging up topsoil to feed into soil burners to actually produce energy. So just like the body, when it dies, it tries to take oxygen out from underneath its fingernails to survive, the corporations are now doing everything in their power to take everything that you care about and turn it into dollars. That's what's happening, and it's going to get worse over the next 10 or 15, 20, 50 years, no matter how long it lasts. And so the question is, are you in it for the long term? If you are, then it means having an eye towards what needs to happen in New Hampshire as you move forward with these individual ordinances. The individual ordinances are just the first step. They're not the last step. They're the first step towards something larger. You have other communities in New Hampshire that have been moving on different issues. The question is, can you link hands with them to move something bigger? And so that's my spiel.
Lots to think about. Thank you very much, Tom. We have time for questions and answers, and Tom is willing to provide the answers if you have the questions. There's a mic over here. Please state your name and your town, and we're open for discussion.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.